Blog Talk Radio.
Greetings and welcome to Mount Olympus. I am Hercules Invictus, and tonight I'm proud to bring you the Pep Talk with John Carl Pepe. But before we get to that, a quick legend of Hercules. Tonight we'll be looking at Hercules, Twilight of a God. Warning, spoilers ahead. Issue number one, in the far future, Hercules has brought peace to the Andromeda Galaxy and has established a stellar dynasty under the emperorship of his son. And he's also a grandpa. Alas, while routinely saving his planet, he met with an unfortunate accident that affects his mind. The recorder is present, as well as Skippy the shape-shifting Skrull. A plot is hatched to discredit our hero and turn public opinion against his family, challenging their right to rule. Complicating things even more, a herald of Galactus has arrived. And no, it's not Nova. Issue number two. Galactus has become a black hole, and his herald, who is a caricature of the Silver Surfer, wants nothing more than to kill Hercules for events that transpired in the first miniseries. An epic battle with the unexpected and tragic loss, Hercules triumphs, but then collapses as battle's end. Issue number three. Hercules is rumored to have died, and chaos reigns in the Andromeda Galaxy. Skippy, though dying himself, impersonates the unconscious Olympian and saves the day, as well as the dynasty founded by his muscular friend. A solution to the dilemma presents itself, but only Hercules can pull it off. But can he? Issue number four. Hercules is revived and saves the day. The recorder, who's now evolved, will preserve and remember these events. Skippy honors Hercules through a time-honored Skull tradition. Galactus is restored. The real big bad turns out to be Lyanna Sweetwater. Spinkor gets what he deserves. Juno becomes a herald of Galactus. And Hercules becomes the celestial life-bringer Cosmos. This issue, titled The End, wraps up Bob Layton's decades-long Hercules saga quite nicely. But does it? Only time will tell. And now to John Carl Pepe in the Pep Talk. Greetings, John. How are you?
Excellent. And how are you, Hercules?
I'm doing great, and I'm looking forward to your show tonight.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, yeah. I love that recap of the Hercules mini. I love the Bob Layton work that he did. We've talked about that extensively, and I was happy to see that you reposted your interview that you did with him, which is fantastic. If anybody has not heard that interview, definitely seek it out. Hercules Invictus interviewing Bob Layton. It is awesome. It is a really, really an interview worthy of the gods.
Well, thank you very much. Now I'm looking forward to your awesome show. The
thanks.
Baton
and,
is
really,
yours. Yours.
And really quick, I do want to wish you a happy anniversary, or at least a version of you. September 1st, 1963, the Mighty Hercules cartoon first appeared on the airwaves, and it informed a lot of young people's lives and introduced them to the mythology, and was even influential in the design of Superman by Bruce Timm on Superman Animated Series, which I've talked about before. One of the hallmarks and highlights of Hercules as being represented in pop culture. Welcome, my flowers of light, to the Pep Talk for Sunday, September 3rd, 2023. This is the Labor Day weekend, so happy Labor Day weekend to everybody. This is our last show of the summer, and before we get into it, a couple of things I just want to note. Another anniversary, I just want to wish Brittany and Joe happy five-year anniversary. Love you guys. You are the best siblings-in-laws that anybody could ever ask for. I do want to wish my condolences to the parrot heads out there in Margaritaville. Raise a drink for Jimmy Buffett because, in the pop culture landscape, he definitely loomed very large. You cannot underestimate the impact that he had. And finally, I do want to wish a very happy birthday to a true blood brother of mine, Fred Garantabi. Fred, like my guest tonight, is one of the greatest guitarists that I have ever had the pleasure of knowing. And Fred and I go way, way, way back. And I love him. He is a true brother and just a wonderful human being. So, Fred, if you're listening, I'm hoping you have a great birthday. And my love to you and the family. All right, folks, let's rock. So this is, as I said, the last show of the summer, and as we do exit the halls of the summer, I always like to reflect on summer's past. And many years ago, a friend of the show and first guest, Bart Capuano, coined a term while we were on one of our hiking trips through Harriman State Park. We were just looking out at this beautiful scenery because our lives have great cinematography. And that has always stuck with me, especially when it comes to matching music with the cinematography of our lives. And one of my favorite forms of music is instrumental rock. I know it is most commonly known, I think, as post-rock. I call it math rock. And one of the premier bands in this instrumental rock and roll music scene has got to be Caspian. And one of the members of Caspian happens to be another very dear, dear old friend and brother of mine. And this band's music has definitely contributed to so many moments of great cinematography in my life as well as others. So, man, welcome to the Lodge, our guest on the Pep Talk tonight, Johnny Ashburn.
Hey, John. How are you?
Good, man. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. It's good to be here.
Good. Welcome. Welcome to the Lodge, as I said.
Thank you. Yeah, no, I appreciate the Twin Peaks references. Oh, man.
Look. There's going to be a few of them. All right. But like I said, I'm not going to talk about Judy. But let's get into it. Let's get into the interview. My first question for you, John, is what year is it? another. See, John, this is my thing.
What is past?
Right. So this is my thing, man. I love to start the interview. I love to start it with obscure references and or in jokes that really only play between, as far as I know, me and the guest, because I feel there's no better way to alienate an audience from a podcast than right at the beginning. You just gotta weed out the chaff, right from the beginning there. So my first question really is, what are you up to? What's going on right now?
We are kind of in a transition period, as a band, at least. I guess maybe before the band stuff, I'll just get right in, like, just a general overview. For me, it is getting close to my the end of my least favorite season of all of them. Mm. So that's nice that I can finally get another summer out of the way. I know this is an unpopular opinion, but I just do not like summer. Like, it's the absolute worst. And you know, somebody has to not like it. I appreciate the people that do, but I personally am looking forward to fall and the other season.
Yep.
I'm up in Portland, Maine right now, so I can't complain too much. We actually, you know, I just keep moving further and further north as the years go on. I think I'm stopping here, but just as a, in general, let's talk about the weather kind of thing. Not for nothing, but I am glad summer's almost over.
Because you like a good winter. You like a good winter, right? You're a big snow guy.
Fall, I mean, fall is the best. Winter is second, and then spring is absolutely fine because after a couple of winters up in Maine, you're just like, you're ready for spring, but not ready for summer. Like, you just cross that one out, and I can skip it every year. But it's an unpopular opinion, but that's fine.
All opinions are welcome on the Mount Olympus Podcast Network, and especially on the Pep Talk, unless it contradicts with how I feel about something.
Naturally. Let's see. For Caspian, it's kind of a transition time. We're between records right now, towards like the last record cycle was interrupted.
Yes, we'll get to that.
COVID, and we will. We're kind of in a transition period, so we're taking things as they come. I got a couple things lined up, but we'll get to that stuff in a little bit.
And you guys just did a mini tour on the East Coast, right?
We did, yeah. It's just a couple days. We did a Boston show. The band is mostly, we were originally Boston-based. We're all spread out now. We did kind of like a hometown-ish Boston show at a place called the Middle East, which is an old, a real classic Boston, divey rock and roll venue. And unfortunately, it's going to, believe it or not, get turned into condos at some point soon.
Just almost like the Wetlands, it is going to go away. So,
Pay's paradise. That's unfortunate, but it was nice to get back there for one last little hurrah in a tiny, stinky backstage with just a bunch of your oldest, dirtiest friends. And then did a couple shows in New York. It's just a little one-off. As we're getting older, our bass player is going back to get his master's. One of us has a couple kids, so we're kind of, as we get older, we're touring less, but we're still doing it almost 20 years later, which is kind of wild.
One of the places you play when you were in Brooklyn, it seems to be a new regular stop or regular stop now for you guys, which is such a great environment, great venue, great vibe, St. Vitus Bar, right? That's the place that you guys are playing a lot in Brooklyn recently. And I've gotten to see you guys there a couple times, and it's a really cool place to see a show, especially just on a real, close, intimate level. Even in the dead of winter, it can feel like summer inside as far as the heat that gets generated from the rock and roll that is emanating from the stage. And now you have a little bit of a thing coming up overseas, correct?
We do, yeah. At the beginning of December, we're headed back over to Asia for the, fifth time, I think. Initially it started out with us just doing some shows in China over there, and kind of branched out a little bit, and we'll be headed to Thailand and China and Taiwan, Hong Kong, Singapore, and some other places, I'm sure. We always look forward to that quite a bit. The last time we were there was in December of year 2019.
Okay.
Which, I don't think it's our fault. But we were there in Wuhan in December of 2019. And let me just tell you, Wuhan, incredible city with great street food. Even if you don't know what it is, it's very good. I didn't really mention that story for a little while after COVID hit, but then after a year, I was like, all right, I can start.
So do you think the rock that was generated?
I can start making jokes about this now, I think. We didn't bring it back, but it's been going on. We were in Wuhan in December of 2019.
So do you feel that the rock that was generated from your show in Wuhan, much like the atomic test in the New Mexico desert, opened up a rift in space time and allowed?
Well, I didn't. But now that you mention it, I think that's my way.
I said I wouldn't talk about Judy, but I think, you know, I think that might be what happened there. So that's
funny,
interesting.
Though,
yeah.
So with Wuhan, there's like, you know, when we heard that it had come out of Wuhan, like, for me, I'm like, I know that place. Like, everyone else is like, they're like, it came out of where? But me, I'm like, oh, yeah, that's one of my favorite places I've been in China. It's like this, it's a huge city. And
yeah.
Our shows there are always tons of fun. They have, like, the venue is on, like, the ground-ish floor. The hotel is above it. And there's a punk rock venue, or a punk rock, like, bar down below the venue. And so after the show happens, all the band goes down to this, like, punk rock bar in China.
Cool.
Which looked every bit like a St. Vitus or something like that.
Right.
And, you know,
plastered with
stickers, that afterwards.
Like, yeah.
And it's just like a, you know, it's just not kind of, it's not what I would have imagined China to be. Just in the best way, though. It's just like all these, like, music kind of, music can kind of bring all of these, that same kind of the world together in a way where it's like, you know, I find a lot of cities to be very similar, and in some ways boring, but like the punk scene, like, that just kind of like thrives everywhere, even in a place like China, which is just, in terms of like freedom of expression, it's kind of hit or miss, to say the least.
Sure, sure. You know, it's funny you say that about how music can bring so many different people together. And one of the things that I really love about what you guys do is that it's, you know, some post rock bands can you know, get a little weird, right? And can be a little impenetrable to the casual listener. The way that Caspian
definitely like too mysterious sometimes, and we've been guilty of that for sure.
Yeah.
In the past. Like,
yeah.
It's like, oh, it's just, you know, a bunch of dudes wearing all black, and like, just might seem unapproachable, but we're all just like a bunch of clowns. Like,
oh yeah,
friends,
you are
friends
absolutely
playing, friends. Oh, for sure, yeah, friends playing music together, and you know, it's
yeah,
you know, maybe earlier on we put on some airs, but you know.
We have to. You kind of have to. But, you know, I'm not even talking about, like, band presentation or the look or anything like that. I'm really talking about the type of, you know, the type of music that you guys compose. And I say compose because they are, like, classical music pieces where there are you know, movements and changes and things mm-hmm. that just sort of, you know, little pieces that build up this greater work. And every song, you got, and for those that don't know, What's Wrong With You, stop listening and go find some Caspian to listen to. Not the rapper, because that's not what we're talking about. We are talking about...
We usually come up first.
yes. And then come back and finish this interview. But anyway, So you know that you, it is each song tells a story, and it is, you know, so I think of like Godspeed You Black Emperor, or you know some even deeper post rock bands where the music itself can be so scary, you know, almost scary, right? Which I love spooky music
fully,
and stuff like that.
Fully agree.
But what you guys do is that you are kind of pulling from everything to almost have a pleasing sound overall. It's soundtrack music, right? It's a soundtrack of our lives, that kind of music that you guys do, and the way you do it, where it is, you know, you have your slower melodic songs, you have your heavier hard songs, you have great build, progression, denouement. One thing I love about the way your albums are constructed are musical motifs that will be quoted throughout an album. I think of like the Aeternum Veil on Dust and Disquiet, you know, that main Dust and Disquiet riff that almost kind of peaks through the whole album, or on some of the earlier
good ear.
Stuff.
That's actually the best example out of all of them of themes returning throughout songs.
Yeah. Yeah, or the
well
one, Thank you. Yeah. Or the Calliope, that twisted Calliope sound that shows up on Waking Season, as well as that other album with Ghost of the Garden City, which is such a cool title for a song, because I went to school and went to college in Garden City, New York, at Adelphi University,
right. The
Harvard of Long Island. And that song was written before I think you were part of the band or anything like that. I don't even think that song is about that Garden City, but boy, that resonates with me because, yeah, I got some Ghost of the Garden City. But so with all of that that goes, you know, into your music, how do you guys construct a song? How do you build an album, so to speak? I want to get into that, and then I want to get a little bit into the history of the band.
Cool. Yeah. I guess for song construction, it's really different than where, like, I had come from musically. Like you mentioned that it's constructed in a, like, relatively classical kind of way. And that's true because Aaron Berkman, a former member, with a classically trained guitarist, and a lot of the guys in the band have a deep, deep understanding of music theory and what works. Or what works and, like, why it works. I do not have that same, like, background in any way, shape, or form. So it was really interesting when I joined Caspian, having to, like, fit into this world. Like, I was born and raised in Washington, D.C., and I was going to see Fugazi and these kind of, like, small indie rock or the emo bands, like early emo, which, you know, I guess really get into that term, but just kind of like growing up in like the whole hardcore punk kind of DC scene and coming out of that. Like,
Jimmy Eat World was so a big favorite of yours, right?
They used to be so good. I kind of like came up in this whole punk rock ish or indie scene. And there was, you know, I never had a lesson, and, you know, I just kind of played by ear poorly for a long, long time. And I just kept working, like, I just kept on working at stuff and playing guitar. I'm sure I could have gone about it in a way that would have made me more, like, a little bit more educated musically, but I did not, because it was partly laziness and then just partly the whole, like, punk aspect of just figure it out. Who cares what any of this means? If it sounds good, it sounds good. So when I joined Caspian, like, their writing style is just fully, you know, it is, you know, the first writing sessions I was in, I'm like, I don't know what any of you are saying, you know, but like, it's like, all right, well, let's play through it and we'll figure something, you know, we'll figure out something that sounds good. It's not fully necessary. But when you say that stuff is written that way, and Caspian, it really is. And over the years, through the records, as I've been recording with them, like, I have a pretty good grasp on that kind of stuff now, and I'm really appreciative of the opportunity they gave me to have to level up my game. Like, when I joined Caspian, I honestly had no business really playing in a in a band like that, but when they asked me, I said, oh, absolutely, let's do this, and I just figured it out. I played until feel my hands anymore, and I just did that for months straight until I could learn those techniques and stuff like that. All that said, the writing process for the Caspian record, I guess it's not unlike a lot of other writing processes, but for other bands, but it is like, it's, you know, there's a lot of feeling in there, but there's a lot of, like, really, really smart, interesting stuff going on behind the scenes in terms of music theory and playing with, like, I don't know a ton of music theory, but, boy, like, I just love playing with time signatures. I always have. I guess, like, I mean, it's a process. If you would, like, aggregate all of them into a simple form, it's everybody individually coming up with some ideas, and then everybody mm-hmm. getting together and fleshing some of those ideas out, you know, hitting record, coming up with a full set of demos before we go to the studio. Almost every single aspect of every single song is worked out.
Right, of course.
And so there's a whole demo version of everything before we go into the studio. We don't go into the studio and write. Like, we go into the studio ready to go and prepared, because studio time's expensive. We're a post-rock band. Not a lot of people listen to post-rock. We don't have a ton of money to throw at albums, you know? Got to be in there and, like, be ready. So, you know, yeah. kind of doing a bunch of demos, getting into the studio and executing it. Kind of, but then also, like, when you are in the studio, if you do have this big thing mapped out, there is room to get weird and, like, have a little bit of fun with it.
Sure.
And, yeah, we're certainly no strangers to that. But, yeah, it's largely, like, things are largely put together once we go into the studio. That changed a little bit for Uncircles. There was some stuff that we kind of left open-ended, which yeah. was a fun little exercise.
Yeah.
But, yeah, it really all starts with just us, like, individually at home doing some recording and bringing it all together in some sort of, like, not quite air-conditioned enough space. We all got sweaty for a couple weeks and yeah. see what happens, you know?
So it's sort of more akin, I guess, to, you know, rather than say, you know, Phil Jameson coming in with, you know, saying like, okay, I have an idea, you know, we're going to have this kind of movement at the beginning, and we're going to go to this kind of place in the middle, and then we're going to bring it down and then bring it back up again. And then, you know, so I have a couple pieces sketched out. Can you guys help me with these other missing pieces? Or is it more akin to just you guys all walk in with a whole bunch of pieces of the puzzle, like a jigsaw puzzle, you throw them on the table, and then you just see where they fit and what you want to accomplish?
Yeah, it's a little bit of both. I mean, Phil especially oftentimes comes with, like, fully fleshed out, or not fully, but, like, largely fleshed out songs where it's like, all right, this is the overall idea for the song. I recorded this and this and this, you know, some scratch drum tracks and whatever it is, and we'll get in and mm-hmm. get to work on, like, Arcs of Command is kind of that way. And that mm-hmm. song took us just forever to write. Like, that was the first song we started writing, the last one we finished on Dust to Disquiet. But that mm-hmm. was a song that Phil had brought in, like, with a whole vision. But then at the same time, I mean, there are instances, like, and again, especially on the most recent record, on Circles, where it was a little bit less coming in to the rehearsals of full songs and us just sitting down together and kind of challenging ourselves with different approaches to songwriting and, like, kind of creating rules, like, where it's like, all right, so everybody, there's a song called Ansra on Circles, and it's like, all right, so there's no plan for this song, but the only thing we know is that nobody's going to play guitar. And all of us picked out a synthesizer from the studio or brought one with us, and we all sat down and, you know, played with various synths, and that's how that song came about. And so, like, recently, like, as you're in a band longer and longer, I think writing-wise, this is, like, the real key to staying in a band is doing different stuff constantly and challenging yourself mm-hmm. with, like, just create some rules and parameters around each individual song or each individual record, where it's like, we're not going to do this, we're not going to do this, we're not going to do this. And it leaves you with mm-hmm. like less tools, but makes you get more creative. And that's like, yeah. that's the stuff after you've been doing this, playing with the same band, writing music with the same band for a long time. You need to keep things fresh, and creating like boundaries is an easy way to actually like, it's a great way to completely break boundaries in a way.
Yeah. And you know, that's one thing I do love, that, you know, you guys are not afraid of trying different things and trying new things and, you know, putting different instruments in there that, you know, most normally are not part of your toolkit. You know, I think of like the saxophone pieces on Dustin Disquiet, a lot of the piano stuff, the cello stuff that shows up in like Sycamore, and the one of my absolute favorite, it's like so heartbreakingly beautiful, that creaky violin at the beginning of Ishmael.
Yeah,
I love that violin.
I'm like, that was modeled after the sound. So the very first sound in that song is a recording of some loons on a lake that Aaron took while he was hiking the Appalachian Trail. And the whole song was based, was based on the sound of loons. So he has the recording of the loons, and then the violins kind of come in and mimic the loon sound. And that the whole thing was built on that. And, you know, if you were like, with Ishmael, it's like, it's almost, I guess I'm getting back to the Hercules thing, like a hero's journey kind of thing, where the Appalachian, I feel like hiking the Appalachian Trail, I'm sure there's, you could draw an arc around any of those stories about doing that, where it's kind of a similar hero's journey thing, you know, you're in the, and so that one's always had like a close spot in my heart, especially now that Aaron is not in the band anymore. He had a, he had a kid, and had to build out a van and just go travel the country and drive around with his kid and his wife. And that's very cool. I do miss playing that one just because of.
He's a great guy. Aaron's a great guy. Aaron is just super nice and just really friendly and just, you know, very welcoming when I would hang out with you guys. And all of you guys are. Phil, you know, the couple drummers that I've met through the years, the bassist, you know. You guys are super fun. I want to kind of talk about the history and the makeup of the band. But I do want to say it's funny that, you know, with Ishmael, you said it, you know, partly I think because of the circumstances where Aaron wrote it, but it makes you feel like you're hiking the Appalachian Trail. For me, I think it's the name of the song, and that creaky violin. I'm on a shanty on the sea, and I'm getting ready for the fishing trip, and I got like my thirsty sweater on, and my put my pea coat on. I got my hot toddy and my Popeye cap, and you know, I just feel like I feel like a sailor. I feel like a sailor with that song. I just love that song.
That's great.
So, yeah,
it does have kind of a wavy. Has like a wavy, like a swingy kind of wavy back and forth thing with the strings,
absolutely.
Where it kind of does have that feel.
So let's talk a little bit about the history of the band, because you are not an original member, and the band has been around for about 20 years right now. You said, right?
Yeah, next year is it's 20 years.
Whew. Wow, nice.
Just not a lot of things I've done in this life for 20 years. I guess I've been a carpenter for as long. But that's about it, man. I never could have imagined getting to be in a quote unquote real band for any amount of time, much less a band that would have had plenty of time to break up and reform. You know, which we haven't done yet, you know. We just stuck around.
And there have been some personnel changes, though, throughout the years. So the original lineup was Phil, right?
Lineup was Phil and Cal and Chris Friedrich and Joe Vickers. They were a four-piece. In 2004 is when they started writing the first EP.
So 20 years ago, I think you were trying to teach me how to play guitar in the basement of the house that we lived in.
I was trying to teach me how to play guitar.
and I remember I just I I did a fret and I started strumming, and you looked up and you're like, oh wow. I was like, what's up? You're like, you just hit the devil's chord. It's like, it takes years sometimes for people to get that chord. I was like, oh, all right, I'm done. I'm going to put this down and I'm going to just enjoy music.
The brown note. I don't know, take this with a grain of salt. But the brown note, I think, and I'm almost positive this can't be true, but it might be. But it's 2023, right? Doesn't really matter. The brown note, the devil's chord, and I'm not sure what it is because I am not the learned music theory person that the rest of the guys are, but there was a chord that I think was banned by the Catholic Church.
Ah, nice.
And it's like a diminished, like, seventh something. I don't know.
Yeah.
I had a slight obsession for a couple of years with that and just being like, what is the most awkward sounding chord you could possibly have? You know, like,
cool.
Brown note, the devil's chord. It's funny that you bring that up because now I am have some recollection of that.
So they were originally, it was a four piece, and the first EP, and then when did the band start to expand? And
there was the first EP, You're the Conductor, and then I think they got into the first full length, The Four Trees, and then when it came time, the tour for The Four Trees, Hal was not able to go on tour and do all the dates, so Aaron joined the band so that he could do the touring portion of it. Like, Cal and Phil and Joe and Chris were writing, and Aaron would come in and do tour. And then after that tour cycle, they went to write the next record, and it's like, okay, well, we'll just all write it. So then there was three guitarists as opposed to two. And then when it came time to tour again, it's like, okay, well, now we need another guitarist to tour. And that was me. So we kept adding guitars and adding members until we got to three guitarists. And so in 2009, I joined the band and started touring with them. And a couple of years later, started writing with them. There's been quite a bit of changes over the years. I started in 2009. So
you were 15 years. Yeah. Wow. So you were just the touring guitarist, and you didn't play on any albums until Dust and Disquiet, or were you playing but not writing?
I was around for like the Circles sessions, but like, I honestly, at that point, I just wasn't like, I still was like, I still felt intimidated by their depth of musical knowledge, and I'm just like, what am I supposed to add here? Like, I had this whole different writing style that I had, and it took me a long time, not a long time, but it took me some time to get comfortable. Instead of trying to fit into like a post-rock or Caspian sound, just being able to bring stuff to the table that was stuff that I would just normally kind of play, you know, it's like for a while, it's just like, oh, how do I write a post-rock song? Which is the wrong question, like 100% the wrong question. Like that is don't. So like, eventually I kind of got more comfortable, with like my different backgrounds. And now anytime I write something that's like, oh, this doesn't sound like Caspian, I'm like, that's the first thing I want to bring to them, you know? Hey guys, check this out. You know, it's like back in the day, it's like, oh, no, maybe this won't work because it doesn't sound like Caspian. But now when it's like, oh, this doesn't sound like Caspian, I'm like, it's perfect. It's great for Caspian then.
you just want to kind of keep
moving forward.
Because Caspian has this ability to sound like a lot of things. Like, it's one thing that
Yeah, and it's given us the opportunity to tour with like so many different types of bands, Yeah. Like, we play a lot of, like, metal fests in Germany and, like, in Europe in general. But then at the same time, we're also, you know, we did a couple tours in the U.S. here with Minus the Bear, which is kind of
right.
a fun indie operation. And, like it, we can really just weave in and out of a couple different genres. Like, part of it's us being instrumental, mostly instrumental.
Yeah.
And part of it's just, like, the variety of volumes and kind of musical structures that we have. Yeah.
You know, it's funny. Yeah, you have definitely toured with some great bands. And for me, a highlight, when the first time I got to see you guys, band Circle Takes the Square was opening for you guys. And that was so cool, because one of the last nights that we hung out before I left Vermont, you introduced me to Circle Takes the Square, and one of my absolute favorite albums still to this day, as The Roots Undo. It's just a wonderful, wonderful album. And that was kind of cool to see that come full circle, especially since, you know, they were an inspiration for you, and that they were opening for you, at least on that night. I thought that was really cool.
Which is just the most wild thing.
Another band.
I could have imagined the bands. Yeah.
Another band that you guys have toured with a lot. I think one of your favorite bands, and I think was the Link, right? Junius, right? Junius was I think the link for you meeting Caspian.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. So, when I was living in Vermont,
I know it well. You lived in
Vermont. I lived in Vermont with a friend named John. I played in a band called Acrasia there. And
I remember Acrasia rehearsals in the basement, man. It was so cool whenever you guys would be down there playing, because it would
demos on a mini disc.
And I loved what you did with Acrasia, man. That was talk about inspiring music. Not only the fact was that it was just emanating from the basement, it was coming from you and those two guys, but it was just such great, you know, again, like soundtrack type music, but like real high octane, go type stuff. And that really, I loved what you guys were putting together back then.
Thanks. Yeah, that was tons of fun. And like, a little did I know, like there's so many of these steps. When I think back, there's so many of these steps that like lead me to joining Caspian. And like, the first step was me deciding to just leave DC at 18 years old and move to Vermont, not knowing anybody there. That was like the first thing that happened. Like, if you're tracing everything back, my decision just to leave DC and go to a place I'd never been, where I didn't know anybody, just to kind of get a fresh start, you need one at 18. It's all kind of traced back to that. Played with this band Acrasia, started a band Acrasia. And then that band played with Junius, who you mentioned, and a band called Constance under a record label called Radar Recordings, which now has a solar-powered studio down in Connecticut, where we still record all of our demos. That's where we rehearse. But we played some shows up there, and I met all of the guys who would eventually plug me into the Caspian kind of scene when the time came. Caspian was looking for a guitarist, and the guys in, you know, Junius, we had played a bunch of shows together, and my bands up in Vermont were, like, everything was good, but, like, there was I wanted to go on tour, even if it was, like, a little tiny, not great tour. I just wanted to go on tour and, like, play music in different places. It didn't matter to how many people, just go play music other places. And I just never had found a band that was kind of, like, able to take that final step, whether it was like college or relationships that kind of got in the way. It was hard to get everyone in the same place. And so when Caspian came calling, We played a show together in D.C. In some early 2009. And they were like, hey, you want to come play 70 shows in Europe with us? I'm like, excuse me?
Sure. You know, and it's interesting because there was a great great music scene in Burlington, especially when we were there, and definitely this sort of this growth of instrumental rock. You know, I think a lot of people put the Cancer Conspiracy up there as a paragon of that type of music, and I think very representative of the music that in that genre that was coming out of Burlington at the
time.
Sure. And they were, you know, they took that show on the road, you know, and there's a lot of people outside of Burlington that know Cancer Conspiracy to this day. And I think one of the problems that I found with the Burlington music scene at that time is very easy to stay locked in, and like you said, various reasons, you know, family, school, whatever, but it was very easy just to stay in and just play around Burlington and have fun and be moderately successful enough at that you're enjoying it, you know. But it was very few bands, I think, that had that drive to break out and do tours, you know. And I think those were the ones that, you know, again, I think had a little bit more lasting power, especially, or at least awareness outside of that town, you know. So I know that, you know, we had, you guys as a band, had, you know, an anniversary, and not a good anniversary, unfortunately. But when, but Chris passed away about 10 years ago, and, somebody who, I mean, not only is his thumbprint all over everything that he did with the band, but boy, he is still part of the band, and his fingerprints are all over, I think, everything after, you know, and not just including the songs that were sort of written, you know, for him. What was that like as a band at that moment? Was there a moment at that point to be, you know, do we pack it in or do we keep going? You know, was that, you know, what was that like for you, especially as, you know, newer to the band too?
Yeah. Man, yeah, it's just 10 years as of August 28th. Yeah, that was, man, that was intense. He was definitely one of the lines, like, in everything he wrote, and it was just such a pleasure being able to play music with him, especially, like, there's just, like, there was a kindness about him that is, like, it's hard to express, which just makes the whole thing, like, even a little bit more difficult, you know, even 10 years on, it's hard to express, like, how easy he made, like, being on tour when you're with the same people for so long. He was just, like, he was a rock of the band. Like, I could talk to that dude about anything. When we had a show scheduled for 3 days after he died, three or something like that, or three or five, within a week of when he died. Yeah. And it was a show, it was a benefit show that he had set up for a friend of his who was raising money for a lung transplant. And so we have this, like, benefit show scheduled when he died, and it's like, well, like, I can see, like, in any other scenario, it's just like, oh, yeah, just cancel the shows, whatever. But this is show that he set up, a benefit show. Like, what are we supposed to do? We still have to do, like, for him. Like, we have to do this. And we had a friend who had filled in for bass on a tour that Chris wasn't able to go to, named John McMahon. And he was able to, in like real no notice at all, just kind of come up and make that show still happen. But I think like the fact that that show still had to happen was something that left no question about what the future was going to be.
Cool.
For Caspian. Like it could have been, it could have been maybe something that like we had to, if we had time to sit down and think about, I don't know, like I could see it going a different way, but like there was just this show that he set up that was right on the horizon. And it was like, well, we have to do this one. And then it was so cathartic and like just moving to have played that, that after that show did happen, it's like, well, this is, you know, we have to keep going, you know?
It's like he knew Johnny, and it was also a benefit for you guys. That's beautiful.
And it's, I mean, I'll never, like, the, and that's hands down the most, like, emotional show that any of us have ever played. We, by the end of it, we were all in tears, visibly on stage, and, like, we set up his guitar, just on a guitar stand, like, front and center on the stage. And just left that there for the whole show. And I mean, it was everything about it was tragic, but there were some things about it that were still beautiful, somehow. And like, he was, I don't know. Yeah. It's a tough thing to have dealt with, but like,
I mean, that's awesome that you guys, you know, carried on, you know, and that he is still, like I said, he still is part of the band, you know, he definitely is informed so much of what you guys do. So we have got about six or 7 minutes left. So I have one more question for you, and then we'll do a little something after that. So, so really, my question for you is, what do you prefer as a musician, John? Do you prefer recording, or do you prefer playing live?
Tough. Rip the baby in half.
You could say all of it. You could say just being able to do it, you know, absolutely.
So
but,
I was just listening to an old interview that David Bowie did with Terry Gross on Fresh Air on NPR, and he was talking about he's like, I just want to write music. He's like, I don't care about touring anymore. This is back in 2006, and he's like, I just want to write music, and I fully get that because writing is so fun, but we're there's still a special place in my heart for performance. I've always been like, after like every single show, I am covered in sweat and my back and my neck hurt because I don't have a lot of control over how much fun I have on stage because it's always just lots of fun, even if my body's not ready for it. So sometimes it just hurts, but it's so fun. So, there's advantages to both. I love them both. I am glad that our touring schedule has slowed down because we used to play 200 and some odd shows a year, like back in the 2009, 10, 11, 12, whatever. We're closer to like, you know, we're maxing out at like 4 or 6 weeks in the road at this point, you know, per year. But like that does work because we all do have businesses and families and, hard to pick one.
Well, it absolutely, I mean, the fun absolutely shows, you know, when you're there on stage or in person, or even a lot of the live stuff that you guys have posted on YouTube. Yeah, folks, if you haven't listened to Caspian, but you really like this interview, or even if you didn't like this interview, just, you know, do yourself a favor, seek out their music. They are on most streaming platforms. Encourage you to go to YouTube and search for their videos not only their videos that have been made and directed by other folks like Arcs of Command or Sad Heart of Mine, which I have a whole thing about Arcs of Command, which I talked about with Hercules on the old show. Maybe we'll have to save that for another go around on the pep talk with you, Johnny. But also, I really encourage you to check out any live Caspian stuff, especially the live at LARCOM. Boy, what an amazing, energetic, emotional thrill ride that really does. You know, sometimes this stuff doesn't transcend through your TV screen. I think this live at LARCOM absolutely does. There was also a gig you did a couple of years ago where you also, you know, once again had a full orchestra on a few pieces. Check out their albums. I mean, Dust and Disquiet is a brilliant album. On Circles, which is your last album that came out in January of 2020, is such
a deluxe
beautiful...
edition. A deluxe edition just came out with the full studio session.
Yes.
Extra songs.
Yes,
so the deluxe edition is out there. It's not available for streaming yet, but you can buy it at caspian.band.
yes, definitely. Definitely. Caspian.net?
.band.
Oh, that Caspian.band.
.band.
B-A-N-D, folks. You know, and I mean, Flowers of Light is one of the most perfectly constructed songs ever created. I love that song. I love that album top to bottom. I love what you guys are doing. I can't wait to see you guys live again. Really quick, I just have two quick bits of Johnny Ashburn trivia here. So one is, John, that you and I were in a movie together. Did you know that?
We were.
We were in a movie called Stash that we shot about 20 years ago in Burlington, Vermont. Johnny has one of the greatest lines ever, which was, you don't have elephantiasis. And I'm not even going to give any context for that. I'm going to want people to seek out Stash. That's also on YouTube. You just search Stash full feature. You should be able to see it. One more really quick bit of Johnny Ashburn trivia before we go. So you mentioned you're a carpenter. You love woodworking. That is not the trivia.
Yeah.
You already mentioned that. but you were actually, you did some work for another fairly big band for a short period of time. You did a giant wooden carving, I'll call it, because you're carving the wood, sure, of a backdrop of the logo of a band called Fun, with a period at the end.
We did.
Did you know you did that? You do.
Yes,
you told me about
it. I did know that I did that. Yeah, no, that was.
That's how I know, is because you told
me. People, anytime anybody mentions that, my first response my mind is like, oh, that was so much fun. And then I'm like, you can't say that. That's stupid.
I was gonna follow this up with
just
to
let you guys know.
That's fun.
Just to let you guys know, we have
less
about a minute.
2 minutes.
Left.
Yeah, we're wrapping up. I was gonna follow that up with so that's fun, literally. So So Johnny, thank you so much for being on the show. You wanna do like a Twin Peaks episode?
Well, there's so much more to do here. Like, you and I could go on for
as
long as anybody will listen. So say the words, and part two.
You got it.
We'll be there. Yeah.
All right. Yeah, we'll do another interview, and then see where we're at. Maybe with in support of a new record. Please get that record out soon. I can't wait. I need more Caspian in my life. And we'll also do a Twin Peaks episode down the road, too, because I think that'll be a lot of fun.
That sounds perfect.
All right, folks.
Great.
Thank you so much for listening to the Pep Talk. Don't forget Caspian.band. You can reach me at the Joker's Child in Fairlawn, New Jersey. And I'm on Facebook, John Carl Yastrzynski Pepe. Folks, until next month, we'll see you at the curtain call.
And thank you, John and John, with the nation without. Thank you for a great show. Take care, and good night to our wonderful audience. Until next time, joyous journeys and amazing adventures. Thanks again.